Meeting of Parliament, Thursday, 11th of April 2019. The Centre of Family Order, the Honourable the Chief Minister. It is incumbent upon me to make a statement. It is not a prepared statement, as I would have liked, as I would have preferred. Very much at the top. But given the events this afternoon, I think there are certain matters that I need to clear up. In 1993, December 1993, on the 3rd of December 1993, the then Speaker, Major Robert Pellissa, made a statement, a ruling, in which he designated what the precincts of Parliament were. And what it amounted to was that the placement in Main Street on the west side was designated by him as being part of the precinct of Parliament. He had taken legal advice, obviously, on the matter beforehand, and he was acting very much in accordance with the practice both in the House of Commons and in the House of Lords. He said clearly that anyone wishing to demonstrate in the area could do so on the pavement on the inside of Main Street, but not on the west side. It was Section 2 of the House of Assembly Ordinance that empowered him to designate the precinct. The calendar also allows the Speaker to, from time to time, to designate what the precinct of Parliament shall be. And I certainly have no intention of departing from the ruling of Major Robert Pellissa. Indeed, I endorse that ruling 100%. But there seems to be doubt in the minds of certain people whom I won't say publicly who they are at this stage. When I arrived just before 2:30 this afternoon, I found the entrance to the gate downstairs blocked by two rows of two young men. We parked out and then another two behind. I had to stop and ask them to step out of the way and let me through. I would have thought that having arrived in an official car and there had been a number of police officers downstairs and being in television so often, they would have known who the Speaker of Parliament is and that my way would not have been blocked in any way whatsoever. The gate downstairs, at least the gate should have been entirely clear whether there were people against the ruling of Major Pellissa on the west side or not. At least the gate should have been clear. I went downstairs and I can explain what I received from the police officer, from the inspector, the response that I would have expected. There seemed to be people who wished to hear the ruling of Major Pellissa. It is for members of Parliament to make that abundantly clear. If necessary, by enacting the amending legislation that would make that abundantly clear. This is a situation, and I think it is most unfortunate. The information that we had previously was that if there was going to be any demonstration, it was going to be in John Mackinac Square. I saw things in the news, it seemed to me that it was going to be on the other side. But in any case, people are entirely free to demonstrate on the east side on the pavement there at the Parliament. Not to obstruct in any way the entrance to Parliament, as I myself have been this afternoon. And perhaps if I hadn't gone downstairs afterwards and demonstrated, maybe the access to some honorable members may have been obstructed as well to the extent that it was in my case.
Mr. Speaker, can I, no doubt, on behalf of all members of the House, associate with your statements in respect of the ruling of Speaker Pellissa and how it must be sense, respected and honored both by those who wish to exercise their perfectly legal right to demonstrate and those who are charged with enforcing our laws and rules. And to see a demonstration must never be something which causes us alarm or concern. It is the expression of people's right to demonstrate, and they do so under the protection of our law, and indeed they must do so within our laws and in the context of the areas around Parliament. And our law is made by the rulings of Mr. Speaker. So, Mr. Speaker, I very much welcome that you have reminded all those who may be listening and wishing to exercise their right to demonstrate of their requirements to comply with these rules, which are indeed intended simply to allow them to exercise their right to demonstrate and not impede access to the place in any way, whilst at the same time ensuring that they're able to exercise that right near enough to this place, which is the heart of our democracy. Mr. Speaker, I'd like to move under Standing Order 7.3 to suspend Standing Order 7.1 in order to proceed with government statements.
Thank you, Senator. And once again, carried.
Mr. Speaker, the United Kingdom has agreed a further extension for it and our departure from the European Union. As all of your members will be aware, the second special meeting of the European Council on Article 50 of the Treaty, held last night in Brussels, resulted in an offer being made to the United Kingdom for such an extension. The President of the European Council, Mr. Tusk, offered the Prime Minister, Mrs. May, an extension of the Article 50 notification period until the 31st of October 2019. Mrs. May has accepted that proposal for an extension. The extension contains no condition that Gibraltar should consider objectionable. The extension has set a maximum period subject to future negotiations for further extension. It has not, however, set out a minimum period. The United Kingdom can leave the European Union if a withdrawal agreement has been finalised before them. Alternatively, the UK can crash out of the EU as a matter of EU law if no withdrawal agreement is finalised and the UK fails to hold European elections. The holding of those elections is a condition of the long extension, but it is not one we would find objectionable. So, with that respect, the United Kingdom has already legislated to hold the EU elections as we have in Gibraltar. The whole House will want to reflect our nation's thanks to the clerk in his capacity as the returning officer for Gibraltar in EU elections, for having moved quickly to ensure that we're able to hold the 2019 European Parliamentary elections in Gibraltar on Thursday, the 23rd of May this year. I promise him I shall not be calling a meeting of the House for that day in the future. Not since our first opportunity to vote in these European elections will our vote have meant so much and been so important in such elections as the future. The politics and drama of Brexit appearing out on the screens of international news channels, and all members will be aware of what is unfolding. The Prime Minister has made a statement this afternoon to the House of Commons upon her return from Brussels. All honourable members will know that on Monday, the House of Commons had legislated a non-government bill into law by the European Union Withdrawal Number 5 Bill 2019. The Cooperation legislation, as the law is known, in effect rules out a departure of the UK from the EU without a deal as a matter of UK law. The underlying reality, though, is that UK law and EU law need to align in order for a no-deal Brexit to be avoided, even by accident. Those mechanisms are now being put in place. I will certainly, therefore, be signing a further amendment to our own European Union Withdrawal Act 2019 to amend the date provided for in our own law for exit step. All the members will recall I did that already on the 28th of March to change the date of the 29th of March and replace it with references to tomorrow or the 22nd of May. Essentially, Mr. Speaker, the pressure for the Prime Minister to revoke the Article 50 notification in the absence of an agreed or agreeable long extension is now off. There is now no need for a revocation of the Article 50 notice to avoid a no-deal departure from the EU tomorrow. I discussed the circumstances. circumstances in which such a revocation might be necessary or indeed appropriate, and possibly with the Prime Minister herself on Friday of last week. These related principally to a cliff edge or an extension which contained objectionable conditions. There was no such objectionable condition in the long extension offer last night from the EU Council, which might have led Gibraltar to push for revocation instead of acceptance of the long extension, other than, of course, the possibility that we might end the nightmare of Brexit immediately and completely and would allow the UK to take back control of the Brexit timetable. The pressure in that respect is now off, but there is now time. And as President Tusk said, we should not wait for that time. If the House of Commons is not able to agree to give effect to the withdrawal deal, and given it has also wisely now legislated not to allow the UK to leave the EU without a withdrawal agreement, the fact is that the stalemate reached in the UK Parliament is unlikely to shift or change. In those circumstances, we must be alive to the fact that there are ongoing talks between the Conservative government and the Labour opposition. These talks could lead to a breakthrough on agreement for the UK to pass the or a withdrawal agreement. This could include a requirement for a so-called confirmatory referendum. Mr. Speaker, given where we are now, the government will continue to take the position it has consistently taken. We will continue to insist that the safest option for Gibraltar is to remain in the European Union. We will continue to support their withdrawal agreement as a way for the UK to leave the EU with a deal. We will continue to support a referendum being held, now referred to not as a second referendum, but as a confirmatory referendum. The long extension now agreed gives us time for that. To this end, I have set in an offer to address a Put It to the People rally in Westminster in London on Tuesday. I was happy to speak alongside serving UK Minister, the Honourable Hugh Merriman MP. Also speaking at the rally were the leader of the Liberal Democrats, Reverend Cable MP, who kindly introduced me to the audience. Ms. Caroline Lucas MP, the leader of the Green Party, Mr. Ian Blackford, the leader of the Scottish National Party at Westminster, Ms. Anna Seabury, one of the members of Change UK, or the Independent People, Civil, Mr. David Lammy of the Labour Party, Mr. Anne Curley of the Labour Party, Mr. Liz Farrell of Clyde Cymru, Mr. Sam Junior, the Conservative former Minister for Universities, the Right Honourable Dominic Greaves, the Conservative former Attorney General, and indeed Dame Betty Boothroyd, former Speaker of the House of Commons and dear friend of Gibraltar, as we visit to Gibraltar, we have a plaque in our own lobby that I was pleased to remind her of at the People's Rally event. All political parties were therefore represented, and Gibraltar was represented. Mr. Speaker, we continue our intergovernmental work in planning with the UK government to leave the EU with the or a deal in case that happens. We continue our intergovernmental work in planning with the UK government in case we leave without a deal, in case that happens. And Mr. Speaker, we continue to represent the mandate of the people of Gibraltar in the 2016 referendum to remain in the EU, warts and all, at every opportunity we have to promote that as a realistic alternative option. Mr. Speaker, although the pressure is off in public, we have worked very hard indeed to be ready for the morning of the 30th of March to ensure we could handle a departure from the EU with or without a deal. We have done the same again for a potential no-deal departure tomorrow night. And we continue to work in the background in that respect to ensure the work we have done is useful if we need to rely on it at a later date. We plan for everything, we ignore nothing, and we prepare for everything, and hope that we shall be able to look back and consider all of that wasted time if we ultimately remain in the EU. So that even if we were to remain in the EU, we would now do so in much better shape in some respect. I should also add, Mr. Speaker, that the measures taken by the 27th for no deal Brexit, in particular on visa free travel, that some have trumpeted triumphantly, are going to be of no effect, at least not this week. So we continue our work, Mr. Speaker, and we will also, as a people, know who to vote for in the EU elections if they are held. Once we know who stands for a confirmatory referendum or other mechanism that enables us to show our preference continues to be to remain in the EU. For the House, Mr. Speaker, we expect we will now be able to resume normal service. I therefore expect to adjourn this afternoon to return to the House on Friday, the 3rd of May at 3 p.m. to continue with questions, motions, etc.
I can very much look forward to that, and I'm sure all honourable members will too. But I'm appreciative, Mr. Speaker, these first couple of weeks, as the political leaders of our nation at this time in our history of our affairs, ministers in my government have looked over the cliff edge at the nose of Brexit representatives, who would easily survive such a Brexit. But it would be unpleasant. It would undoubtedly bring difficulties to some aspects of people's lives, despite our greatest efforts. And it is ultimately unnecessary. For those reasons, I'm very happy that this is an outcome that is, at least for now, avoided, and we should seek to contribute to avoid going forward. I therefore commend this statement to the House, and trust that as matters develop, the outcome of it has hitherto appeared inevitable, may seem less and less certain or inescapable, as they now also appear less and less intended.
Mr. Speaker, questions I understand arising out of those, obviously. Before I do that, Mr. Speaker, on behalf of my colleagues, we welcome the Honourable Chief Minister's statement. And we also welcome, it has to be said, the fact that the Honourable Chief Minister has undertaken not to keep us in this place for too long, because, of course, we have an excellent meeting of the GOD at an AGM at 7 o'clock today. To which all members of the public are welcome to attend, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, including, of course, members of the government, who they wish to cross the floor, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, the only the Chief Minister touched upon the fact that the extension to the 12th of October. Now, my understanding of the position is that if a withdrawal agreement or a version of the withdrawal agreement or a different withdrawal agreement isn't agreed, that then of course we would cut out of the European Union without a deal in the course of the president. Now, we have an incongruous situation of Parliament of the United Kingdom having voted against going out of the European Union without a deal. Did he not agree with you? But therefore, the only alternative, if the will of Parliament is going to be observed, is to revoke Article 50 in a situation where there is no agreement in relation to a withdrawal or a version of the withdrawal. Because, of course, it is also, the government in the United Kingdom could do so, but it would lack democratic legitimacy to also go to the people of the United Kingdom in a people's vote, a second referendum on the withdrawal agreement, bearing in mind that it's also been rejected 3 times by the Parliament of the United Kingdom. And thus, in those circumstances, a revocation of Article 50 would appear to be the only appropriate alternative. The only thing the Chief Minister also said, he referred to the discussions that are now taking place between the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition. And he said, the or any withdrawal agreement might emerge out of that. Have you got any commitment, or have you discussed with the Prime Minister, or anyone else, and have you received any assurances that if there is a variation, or if it's a different withdrawal agreement, that will also extend to Gibraltar and everything else that has been negotiated on behalf of Gibraltar, etc., would also apply to a different version of the withdrawal agreement. Mr. Speaker, do you wish to reply to that or to hear other honourable members?
Thank you to the honourable gentleman for welcoming my statement. We are indeed in a new stage of our political relationship. Not often that we have got up in this House to welcome anything I have said. I'm very grateful indeed that they are at least on this issue, not just today, but in recent memory, he has wanted to associate himself with much of what the government has said and indeed done in respect of this matter. Mr. Speaker, I do not recall having given any undertaking as to the time that this House will sit today. Indeed, I have not given any such undertaking, although I am aware that there is a public meeting this evening elsewhere in respect of honourable members' party. But honourable members should obviously not I'm not going to do anything to stop people from going to their meeting. It is, after all, a meeting to which they've invited 32,000 people. This is a public meeting, and so I'm sure that they will be very disappointed if they don't get many thousands of people attending. Given that it is not a meeting for members, it is a public meeting, and indeed, I know that my honourable friend, Minister for Culture, promotes him stand-up comedy in Gibraltar. Jimmy Carr is here soon, and he was sold out there, but there will be no less than at the very least as many tickets as Jimmy Carr. But there are at least 60 when there's only one here. And yes, it's a public meeting, Mr. Speaker. I know a lot of our people will be going to listen to what they have to say about us. With no impediment, they're going to have to show a membership card, something which they will find anathema, but given that it's public, they will go just to listen. And indeed, I invite many people to go and listen to them to be able to see why they are not a vice choice for Gibraltar for the future. So, if they are not going to ask me to speak on the contrary to the vice chair from here, I didn't indeed join him in trying to promote the event this afternoon. Alongside expensive advertisements in some local newspapers. Mr. Speaker, it is a matter of agreement between us that the revocation of Article 50, although no longer pressing as the only alternative to avoid a cliff-edge Brexit on the 12th of April, is still very much the advisable course of action for the UK Prime Minister. But it's no longer the only course of action available. Now, just to develop the thinking, the Honourable Gentleman, which I think sounds good to see, given that there is now an Act of Parliament that requires the United Kingdom not to leave the EU without a deal, and given that a very withdrawal agreement has not been approved yet, to take the direction that I was saying earlier, in the event that there were no agreement with the EU, it is not legally possible under English law for the Prime Minister now to envisage a no-deal Brexit. So the Cabinet Manual comes into play, and the Cabinet Manual requires ministers to act only in keeping with the law. And it is therefore not possible, I think this is the point that the Honourable Gentleman is making, it's not possible for the Prime Minister to receive advice that he can allow the United Kingdom to fall over a cliff edge when there is a mechanism which is in her hands to enable her to prevent that, in other words, to prevent a breach of UK law. Forget the politics of Article 59. Forget the politics of leaving without a deal. Honourable members who have seen ERG members, some say that a no-deal Brexit or WTO Brexit is what they prefer. English law now does not allow that. So the Cooper Lethwin bill needs to be revoked for that to be an option that is on the table, or the Prime Minister would be in breach of the Cabinet Manual and therefore in breach of UK law, because nobody could give her advice to allow that no-deal Brexit. It is now illegal in UK law. And indeed, Mr. Speaker, when the Prime Minister got up today to make a statement, the first thing that she referred to was the arrest of Julian Assange, who was brutally this afternoon. And in making that introduction to her statement and referring to a topical matter before she started on any matters, she said it was a demonstration that no one in the United Kingdom is above the law. And here I know, as lawyers and others will know just from our own general knowledge of citizens, that the only person above the law is the monarch. That's why criminal proceedings are brought in the name of the monarch against any third party. But the Prime Minister and any minister is not able to allow something to happen which is contrary to the law. So, Speaker, I think we are entirely of the same view there. But when that becomes necessary, in other words, the Article 50 revocation being desirable is something he and I will agree we are happy to see today. That's why I said it would immediately make the nightmare Brexit immediately disappear, and something we would find very positive, subject to having to deal with the democratic aspects of the outcome of the referendum. But when it becomes necessary, it's something quite different. And it would have become necessary tomorrow night, midnight, 1 minute before midnight Gibraltar time, 1 minute before 11 o'clock British time. Honourable members may also want to reflect that in the comments of the European Council, there is the reference to the availability of the Article 50 mechanism. So if anyone in the United Kingdom doubted about the availability of the Article 50 revocation mechanism, the European Court of Justice, the Court of Justice of the European Union, has already made that clear in the Reitman-Brightman case. And yesterday, the chief negotiator emphasized that point. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman asked me about the idea of a V or A withdrawal agreement, in other words, referring me to the possibility of an idea of a new withdrawal agreement. Now, in that respect, you will know that the Labour opposition and the Conservative government, and I said that advisedly, he said the Prime Minister's team and the League of Opposition team. That's why I said the Conservative government, referring to the executive, not the benches, and the Labour opposition, again referring to the shadow cabinet, not the opposition benches, I engaged in it. Now, what the EU has made clear is that they're happy to look at what changes are proposed, but that the withdrawal agreement is closed. And this is the red lines that have been put, and that the political declaration is relevant. And indeed, just from the point of view of what we're all seeing publicly and from the discussions I had, I met with Keir Starmer in London yesterday, Mr. Speaker. I have spoken, as you know, to David Lidden on a number of occasions to the Prime Minister about this subject. The issues that are being put on the table, which are a customs union or access to the single market, are not about what happens on the floor. Because the withdrawal agreement already contains a customs union continuing and the single market continuing. So it's about the future, and that's for the political declaration and how the red lines that led to the political declaration being agreed might be altered about a future agreement. They could have awkward consequences into the withdrawal agreement. So the aspect of the withdrawal agreement that has caused most difficulty is the backstop, which relates to Northern Ireland. If in the political declaration about the future, the United Kingdom government goes back to the EU with the agreement of the Labour opposition, saying that they want a customs union, that has resolved the issue of the backstop, not in the withdrawal agreement, because the issue of the backstop is not in the withdrawal agreement, it's about it not being released once the future starts, so to speak. And so, in that respect, the position of the Europeans is that the withdrawal agreement is done, but there will not be released. But in any event, I have the assurances that the Honourable Gentleman said we should have in respect of Gibraltar continuing to be covered under the withdrawal agreement, even if that were to come. And I'm very pleased to be able to say that. In fact, that's something that I've shared before. I think on that basis, I've dealt with all of the points that the Honourable Gentleman has put to me. But I just want to reflect that, in putting the final point, the Honourable Gentleman is seeking to have reassurances, that we have reassurances, and we've had them, Mr. Speaker, from the Prime Minister. They sometimes, and it's not him that says it, do not reflect so generously on the fact that we have received these assurances as a result of the relationship that we've enjoyed and the work that we've done with this Prime Minister and indeed with other members of Parliament. And I think at times like this, they, and in particular he throughout, noted the importance of that, and I'm grateful for that reflection.
Well, very good. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'd just like to ask the Chief Minister one point really about his statement, and that is he did say he attended the People's Vote campaign meeting in London, along with various other members of the UK Parliament. I was just wondering, Mr. Speaker, whether the Chief Minister would welcome a motion of this type, setting out in a substantive motion, setting out with a view that the preference of this House would be for the people's vote, the referendum, a confirmatory vote, as being the resolution of this House, and if the Chief Minister is in a position to say whether the government would support that motion, certainly we on this side would be willing to consider it. And indeed, we'd be willing to propose it if he is in a position to do that from his side. I'd be interested to know his view on that, and of course, anything else that may help him to put across the unique view of Gibraltar to the Prime Minister. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful for that invitation from the Honourable Gentleman. I do think that the a motion of this House is required for me to be able to put the views of the votes to the Prime Minister, or indeed the forces which are going to be involved. But it is not necessarily something that we should discard in the event that there is a different Prime Minister at some stage, or indeed if we felt that this became appropriate at a different time. But I would say to the Honourable Gentleman, is that this House is able to do many things on the basis of not working together. It is able to do many more things on the basis of working together. And indeed, if we were to take the view that this was necessary, and the Honourable Gentleman thought that it was necessary, I would invite them to work with us on the timing and wording of this and how it is presented, and not to trigger it in a way that they might consider is appropriate if they wanted to do it in a way that is going to have the maximum effect. I don't think the moment has come yet. I think there are a number of things that we need to be clear on. Not least, and I've given an indication of this in the statement I made a moment ago, the positions that political parties take in the European election. Because the European elections may be the first referendum on Brexit since the Brexit referendum after the general election of 2017. Because in 2016, when the referendum occurred, the two leaders of the main political parties defended one position. In the general election, their manifestos reflected the position that prevails in the referendum. Now in the European election, we have yet to see what proposition the leaders of the main political parties will put, and the people of the voters will want to see very carefully the options in those European elections, if it is possible to use the European elections as a first plebiscite on the issue of Brexit. There is an opportunity there which those who represent the lead side in the referendum they have already seen. There is now a Brexit party alongside UKIP, and votes will be counted, in my view, if the vote goes ahead, because of votes for those parties who have stood for a further referendum or remaining, votes for those parties who have stood for just continuing with the Brexit result of the referendum in 2016. I think before we move this House into another political, we need to observe what happens there and consider that very likely to be the first opportunity cut a vote to remain.
Mr. Speaker, the last few weeks have given us in the greater a lot of anxiety, with the present deadline for Brexit looming nearer, and without a clear indication from the House of Commons as to what sort of a Brexit we would end up with. As I have said repeatedly in my press statements and my statements to Parliament, the lack of leadership in the UK has been unfortunate and given rise to a situation which, although not of our making, has caused us a lot of anxiety. The agreement to a long extension gives us some breathing space and allows us to plan for the future with a bit more serenity and calm. But we mustn't let down our guard, Mr. Speaker. And for sure, we must continue trying to influence efforts to revoke Article 50, or failing that, another people's vote, given the lack of unity and clarity in the UK. So any demonstrations, speeches and the like is never enough, and we should do as much of it as possible. I take note of government's continuous assurances that all preparations for a potential no-deal Brexit are in hand, and that regardless of what may happen, we are prepared. And I do hope this is indeed the reality, and therefore I thank not only the members opposite, but the many people behind the scenes who have contributed to this hard work. From this corner of the House, Mr. Speaker, I remain as always ever ready to assist in whatever role is required of me, while continuing to represent the many voices in our community who have any doubts or concerns about the future and bring them before this Parliament. Thank you.
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Lady will be interpreted by me to ask you whether I agree with that at the end of her statement. And I do agree with that. I agree with the fact that it's important that if we receive any concerns from any member of the public about preparations for an ideal, etc., she does share them with us. She knows that she has access to all of us if she needs to, to other honourable members, to raise issues with us. And to raise issues with us, if I may say so, with respect to honourable members, is better than to raise the temperature publicly on this subject. So I do appreciate her saying that she will do that. It's important not just to be prepared, but for people to understand that we are prepared and to feel that we are prepared. In particular, if things go fairly up, others might be trying to use the moment to try and propagandistically suggest to people who do business in Gibraltar that Gibraltar is not ready to deal with the circumstances of those things and to try and lure them somewhere else. So I do welcome the fact that we've been in touch with any concerns that we have. Because there's been a lack of leadership in the UK. Because can I just nuance that for her and for the House a little? Because I think there's been a lot of leadership in the UK. Leadership in the sense of different, very strongly held points of view that have indicated, more starkly perhaps than ever before, that there is a lack of a majority in the House of Commons for one particular view. And indeed, never before has it been so obvious that the House of Commons is made up of 650 different points of view, some of them across party lines, and some of them coalescing around a party line, but just not enough of them to get one particular option over the 325 required to deliver a majority, a guaranteed majority in anything. And she will agree with me, no doubt, that there have been many outstanding voices in the Commons. And not just that of the Prime Minister, who has been caring and sensitive when he has come to Gibraltar throughout this period, but indeed many others who have demonstrated their clarity of thinking, their passion, both in the sense of leaving the European Union and remaining in the European Union or having a further referendum. And all of them, people who the Deputy Chief Minister, other ministers and I have been talking to about the Gibraltar issue, is not lost on any stage of opinion. There are some who say that this is a bad time for British democracy. Probably history will say that this is one of British democracy's strongest moments, where the House of Commons is coming into its own. And I don't yet see what judgment history will pass. But I think on the Commons, and on Parliament, and on the Speaker in London, I think the judgment of history will eventually demonstrate that they were on the right side, doing what their consciences required, always representing passionately their point of view, and not allowing themselves to be pushed in one direction or another, despite their intimidation that one has read that many of them are suffering. And I think you will join me in that interpretation.
The Honourable Trevor Hammond. Mr. Speaker, in light of the news today from the we're reading chronicle from the House of Lords Select Committee regarding the lopsided nature and potentially the breach of human rights that constitutes the tax treaty that has been signed between the United Kingdom and the Kingdom of Spain on behalf of Gibraltar and with the assent of the Gibraltar government. And in light of the fact that that treaty will be binding regardless of the outcome of the Brexit negotiations as they go forward and any future extensions or indeed any revocations of Article 50 or indeed any future referendums on the matter which may halt the entire process. Does the Chief Minister in any way regret not having had wider discussions about the content and nature of that treaty, perhaps included the community at large, in understanding the potential impact on that treaty, on Gibraltarians, on people resident in Gibraltar? Does he perhaps regret not having put the signing of the treaty in abeyance until such time as we actually knew the outcome of the Brexit process, rather than having had it signed and now tying our community to a treaty which, as I say, has been declared by a select committee of the House of Lords to be potentially in breach of human rights?
I am being very liberal in allowing the Honourable Member to raise the question of the tax treaty. It can only be said very, very loosely to have anything to do with the Chief Minister's statement. I'm stretching the point very, very much in allowing the moment that I heard the word tax treaty, I could have asked him to discontinue. But I'm being very liberal. It is up to the Chief Minister whether he wishes to deal with the matter or not. Also, we are anticipating events. There is a motion on the agenda for to debate the tax treaty. It's up to the Chief Minister. I don't think he can be compelled under the rules to answer the point both under two different traditions.
So, Mr. Speaker, having heard the point raised by the honourable gentleman, I do wish to deal with the things that he has said with the caveat that there is a motion to come. And I did not refer to the tax treaty in the context of the statement I have made, because I don't think it was relevant last night in the determination of the European Council. But the honourable gentleman tempts me to reply to what he has said, and I'm looking forward to it. I had no doubt, Mr. Speaker, that I would be dealing with this point today in the House as a result of the statement, even though it didn't arise. So I had given some thought to the answer I would give to the point that I knew honourable gentlemen would make.
Although I'm surprised about who they are. Now I think that I am aware of the fact that on the 1:30 news, the Chief Minister was asked about the matter. I don't know whether the Honourable Trevor Hammond was listening to the 1:30 news. I make it a point every day of listening to the BBC News at 1:30 because I need to keep myself informed, obviously.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. So I will start where the Honourable Gentleman ended. He said, do I regret having done the thing in the way that I did and not in the way that he says that he would have preferred me to do? Well, Mr. Speaker, would be the best and easiest way to reflect the position of the government. Because, you see, as the Honourable Gentleman says, he says, the House of Lords has declared that the tax treaty is potentially a breach of human rights. So that's not a declaration, Mr. Speaker. The House of Lords has said that they ask the question of whether or not they are potentially breaches of human rights. Look, the government took advice on this before we agreed to the treaty. And the advice we have was that there were not breaches of human rights. Now, Robert Jones said, if you had socialized the treaty further, you might have had the benefit of other advice. So look, having socialized the treaty very widely afterwards, including with them, and indeed with lawyers from across the community in Gibraltar, including some who have been politicians in the past, nobody has suggested to us that there's a breach of human rights. So, simply answering the narrow point that the Honourable Gentleman makes, which is, if you had socialized it further, would you have been told about the human rights problem, and would you then therefore not have done it, and do you regret not having done the socialization of the treaty, therefore? Well, having done the socialization of the treaty, the issue has not arisen. Now, let us assume for a moment that the Select Committee, simply raising the issue, which is what they're doing, raising the issue for consideration, their role, and they're absolutely right to do it. What would be the consequence? The consequence is simply that taxpayers affected will be able to engage the Supreme Court of either Spain or Gibraltar, or indeed the European Court of Human Rights, for a determination of whether their human rights are in fact impaired by the treaty. And if it is, the effect will be that the treaty will have to be considered amended by any finding of those courts which protect the human rights of those individuals. Which, of course, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman might like to reflect, would then involve the recognition of the Supreme Court of Gibraltar by the Spanish legal and political establishment. Because the treaty could not go beyond that, they would be bound by those findings. So a further additional massive benefit and step forward for the people of Gibraltar as a result of the tax treaty. So Mr. Speaker, the tax treaty is not something that concerns working people. It's not something that concerns people who are looking at how they're going to continue to derive the benefit of living in Gibraltar. It is something that they concern some very, very rich people. Some very, very rich people who have not properly organized their affairs in order to be in regularized their position with the expenses of Spain or Gibraltar, but not otherwise. Otherwise, it's just an instrument for planning, for knowing how issues are going to be resolved. And in respect to speaker of the issue that creates the reference to human rights in the Select Committee finding or question, it arises from the principle of asymmetry. Now, the principle of asymmetry is one that honourable members, unless they wanted to make mischief with the treaty, which I have no doubt is what they are going to do when the time comes to debate it, the principle of asymmetry is one that is born out of difference, not out of inequality. So, in other words, it's not that Spain has come to this negotiation with a blunderbuss and has been able to intimidate us into giving them more than we get from them. What it is, Mr. Speaker, is simply the difference between two positions. One system that has a territorial system of taxation, and the other one that has an extraterritorial system of taxation. The territorial system of taxation is based on taxing the money where they arrive, where they are earned, or where they are remitted. The other, the worldwide system of taxation, needs as much information as possible about the individual to find his money wherever it may be in the world to tax it. So one system needs more information than the other system needs. And so, Mr. Speaker, in those circumstances, the asymmetry does not, in our view, create any difficulty whatsoever. There are many other examples of asymmetry in international treaties because the parties coming to the treaty come with different objectives. Our objective is not to find out the worldwide assets of those who will be subject to the treaty on taxation in Gibraltar because those worldwide assets are irrelevant to taxation in Gibraltar. Now, that's the reality. That's the reality. All the members will be seeking to make mischief in respect of this widely for the next few months. Indeed, this evening at the show, the Honourable Chancellor has invited everyone to, everybody to come to, at 8:30 this evening, here today. Although I understand it's an important football match on this evening as well, Mr. Speaker, and I'm involving a couple of teams. They will be seeking a mandate, not from everybody there, I suppose, but from only those holding the membership card. They know how to manage that. To give notice of revocation of the tax treaty of their election. As I said, Mr. Speaker, I'm very pleased that they're going to do that, because at the next election, when the vast majority of the people have understood the treaty, the last thing that right-thinking people in Gibraltar will want to do, in particular, is by when they're going to remain in the European Union, is revoke the treaty. But, Mr. Speaker, on the point of human rights and wider discussion with the community before entering into the treaty, I will leave the Honourable Gentleman with two things to chew over. He, I assume, like I, and everybody else, had to read the Cordoba Agreement after they were entered into by the former administration that he represents in this Parliament. So much for wider socialization of agreements that are entered into before they are socialized. And second, Mr. Speaker, when it comes to breaches of human rights, the progressives are sitting here on this side. We are the ones who have changed our laws to take steps forward on equality. And we are the ones who are going to bring a bill to this House to ensure that we are not in breach of our Constitution or the European Convention of Human Rights in respect of a woman's right to terminate pregnancy. They are the ones seeking a mandate tonight not to do so. So much for concern for human rights.
The Honourable Samantha for commenting.
Mr. Speaker, thank you for the opportunity to make a statement this afternoon about the exact timing of sales of our new development in affordable homes. Mr. Speaker, housing is a fundamental cornerstone of our community, and our government has an unprecedented track record in providing for Gibraltar's housing needs at every level. Providing affordable housing is a top priority for us. Having already proved ourselves in the construction of affordable housing to a high standard, as well as building purpose-built flats for the elderly in our first term, which provided in excess of 1,000 new homes, we have already announced our second wave of affordable housing at Hassan Centenary Terraces, Hopefully Commune, and Wilford Avenue. Additionally, we will further provide 161 former energy properties which have already been sold at tender, the completion of which will commence from the 1st of August after the end of the Island Games. I know that our families are excited about purchasing and moving into the new homes on some of the best real estate in the world. In respect of the 50-50 schemes, Mr. Speaker, we launched our first project, the construction of Hassan Centenary Terraces, in December, and I am immensely satisfied at the interest that has resulted. The deadline for applications closed at the end of January, and the response has been overwhelming. I am delighted to announce that the final figure for applications received having eliminated those who are ineligible is 2,341. That is almost four times the number of flats available and therefore proof as to the interest in acquiring these properties. Since then, the teams of both GRC and the Housing Department have been working together to filter and process the application. This process has taken a little longer than with previous developments because of the way in which we have radically changed the allocation process. We have given a lot of thought to the manner in which we will allocate these flats to ensure that the allocation process will be as fair as possible. Mr. Speaker, I wish to share some important statistics that will demonstrate the real impact that our affordable housing strategy will have. And it is important to note that these figures relate only to the Sands and Canary territories. So indeed, there will be further impact as we progress with our underdevelopment. We have given the first priority in allocation to those who are currently government tenants and will release government flats, and there are 130 such applications. Mr. Speaker, all these applications are guaranteed a flat. Furthermore, as a result of our carefully thought out incentive whereby unmarried couples are eligible to a three bedroom home if applying jointly, as opposed to otherwise acquiring two bedrooms each if applying individually, results in greater availability of two bedroom flats for others, and will also avoid no resulting empty flats in the long term. We have 197 such joint applications, which would otherwise have been 394 individual applications. That means essentially that we will have a further 197 flats available. A clear benefit will therefore be gained by all the other applicants to purchase on the one faculty list, of which there are 850. The community will see that there will be changes to the conditions of resale to ensure that these flats, which are intended to be used for owner occupations, are not purchased for speculation or any other form of profiteering. We are changing the underleases for the new development to further tighten any possibility for abuse, something I know the whole community will want to support. Indeed, in this respect, we have already acted by introducing a set of stamp duties to prevent profiteering of CC terraces and on-site communities. Mr. Speaker, I know that there are many applicants for the San Quintino terraces who are very soon to receive that important phone call offering them the opportunity to buy one of these homes. I can this afternoon confirm to the House that we shall commence the process of calling applicants for allocation on Wednesday, the 24th of April. Finally, Mr. Speaker, the next development will be Bob Felicia News, and our final development in this wave will be at Newport Avenue. The designs and plans for Bob Felicia News will be launched before the summer, and the sales will take effect shortly thereafter. Today, Mr. Speaker, I wish to make a further very important announcement in relation to that estate. The government has decided that the estate will follow the model we have successfully pioneered at Mumsdale Vineyards and will include a block for renting. That block will provide purpose-built accommodation for the elderly. Not only will this result in a better quality of life for our elderly citizens, but it will also release their current, mostly government rental accommodation, back into stock for the benefit of those members of our community who cannot purchase and who need to be able to rent from the government. We anticipate that these first two developments alone will see at least 200 housing rental properties being released and therefore made available to those on the waiting list. This is another real advantage of our construction of affordable housing for others who may be unable to afford to purchase in these communities. We are therefore providing affordable housing for our community, but our process also has that important consequential effect on our provision of rental stocks that we all want to see. Mr. Speaker, this is an exciting time as we continue to offer affordable housing to our community. Thank you for allowing me to make this statement and provide this important information to the House.
Anybody with the Honourable's attention?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I thank the Honourable Lady for her statement. I'm sure there have been lots of people out there waiting to hear what the result of the application is. If I may ask the Honourable Minister, in terms of the start date, when does she anticipate start breaking ground on her Hassan-Centenary teleport? And also, is the breaking of ground in any way dependent on the moving of the double mount on the side of the adjacent to the part of the plot? I'd be grateful if the Minister could answer that. And also, just if you can just confirm that from her statement that it would appear that she has no intention of constructing any new rental property.
Mr. Speaker, I will start with the last point first, in that the Honourable Gentleman seems to not have heard, but I have just said the opposite. And I have confirmed that we will be constructing new homes for rental. And Mr. Speaker, in relation to breaking ground, we anticipate to do so in the third quarter of this year.
Can I ask the lady to clear the complete confusion that I have? She's just confirmed that she said in her first part of the statement that she was building rental houses, but did she not add at the beginning that those rentals were going to be for the senior citizens only? Can she confirm that?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, and they were rented. And so, in answer to the question that they are trying to figure out themselves, Mr. Speaker, we are adding to the rental stock by way of the additional block for the elderly that we will construct, as well as the significant number of government dwellings that will be released to those purchasing affordable housing who are currently housing tenants. And because of the way that we are undertaking the allocation, which is a different way in which it's been done in the past, we'll release the significant and substantial amount of government dwellings.
I think the one thing I said that they did very well in government, they introduced the concept of Bishop building a house, and we welcome the fact that they did that. It was a new concept at the time. They introduced 50-50, they introduced that. We look at a different way of doing the allocation because we think we can get more move of elderly persons to one of those residences if you look down the chain of who takes their property. But the experience we have, and this is the point that the Honourable Lady makes, if you build 70 flats for the elderly, and the elderly are living in 3, 4, 5 bedroom accommodation where they brought up their family, you release that and other properties in a trickle down effect. Because the family that might move into a 5-bedroom that is presently occupied by an elderly couple might move to 3-bedroom that goes to somebody who is either completely on the list, not in their own home, or in a smaller property going up. And that's why we improve it, so to speak, to produce more properties. If instead of building housing for the elderly, we were simply to build a new block of 3 and 4 bedroom accommodation, what happens is that you build new houses of 3 and 4 bedrooms for people who are waiting for them, and you leave elderly people who are in 3, 4, 5 bedroom accommodation in 3, 4, 5 bedroom accommodation. It's not a good way to manage the stock of housing that we have available. Therefore, I invite them to agree with us, as we have agreed with them, that this is the best way to manage the rental stock.
Well, I guess I'd thank you, Mr. Speaker, or thank you to the 2 minutes for explaining. And we do understand and certainly and as opposed to that logic, you know, of building the big size bedroom because it does alleviate not just one family, but in a hypothetical example it's giving us 2 or 3 more families there. However, Mr. Speaker, I have mentioned 2 minutes in the past and he said it was something in general we want to look into. If I can use a personal example, Mr. Speaker. When we were young, before we had white hair, my wife and I decided to purchase one of these ownership schemes and so on. We are now being penalized by having purchased our property and not being able to enjoy what those who depended on the taxpayer to continue having rental accommodation and therefore would not be entitled to move into these wonderful, whoever built them, the wonderful citizens in homes. My wife and I are in a position because we are homeowners we kind of got tired of that, you know, and to sell my property, to move, you know, to something downsize and so on, is not the same as moving into a perfect big community area where citizens can share that companionship, their needs, and so on. Has the minister made any progress in something that he said he would like him to, in respect of those of us who are deemed home purposes, that kind of aspire to living in this type of accommodation he says for senior citizens?
Is there only interval do we consider sitting on a massive profit between the price that we pay for affordable home and the price that we use to sell it today, a penalisation? This is no doubt what the Spanish might call the greatest penal colony in the world. Because I understand that the older gentleman would like to live in the accommodation which is now being prepared for the elderly as a tenant, paying rent. But we have to understand that the purpose of the elderly accommodation, which they created, was to become other rental accommodation. Now, what I said to him, and we're still working on, is whether we can find a mechanism, not necessarily funded by the government, but perhaps in which the government is an investor, where the private sector brings about this sort of home, which allow individuals who have bought affordable homes to sell those affordable homes, keep a share of the return, and purchase similar accommodation. I mean, obviously, the only thing I wanted to give the government the property that he bought, so that then be prepared to put him into this sort of accommodation. But to say I wish to keep the profit and benefit of the capital growth, because remember that this is capital growth. You buy it one price, you pass, you pay your mortgage. But the difference between the amount you pay and the value of the property today is the capital growth. And in Gibraltar, it is usually quite huge, especially if you bought from the government. If you bought from the retail, it's different. But you bought from the government. So today, the capital growth is huge. And we're talking about many hundreds of thousands of pounds if you bought them that way. Now, and despite that, we are asking for a rental property from the government. Well, let us see that in those 7 months, we're not able to help. But we are looking at other possibilities that might free up the market in purchase accommodation and provide one-bedroom style accommodation for twilight years, and I don't regard him as being anywhere near his twilight years in particular. He's still doing a lot of war in this place, and I hope to see him here for many years, so that market can also find another estate. But the capital growth is very valuable indeed. It's part of the wealth that has been created as a result of successive affordable housing projects in Gibraltar, and that is one of the great successes of the first year of the administration of 1988, the creation of that home ownership culture and the wealth that comes with it.
Right. No, Mr. Speaker, I just want to tell you that. Yeah. Just to clarify, in case of any doubt, that I wasn't referring to necessarily as having been a homeowner, which is still up. I don't want to move into rental section. I just want to move into some sort of facility similar to, you know, as close as possible to that, which is why if you need any information to have to repair the section, I leave that to them. I was just asking my original question was, have you made any progress from what he and I agreed 2 years ago was something that perhaps we can even work together, like the business that wants to keep on promoting, or to finding that, so that generation, you know, like the other members of my, we're now in our early 60s, and although not quite in certain 12 years, but we are looking to another phase of life, and therefore another phase of accommodation.
If you think you're being so liberal today, that the Deputy Chief Minister can claim you as a member, if you're not careful. This is what is ongoing. There are now new opportunities for this because there's going to be more land available, in particular the magnificent Victoria Kings development, which will allow, as I said, for affordable development, not necessarily 50-50 development, but affordable development. And this is something that we've seen looked at, as I said. It's not something which is easy because the capital growth in these properties would have to be controlled so that the investment is one you can make, but not one which you then make so much capital growth on as well that another couple in future are not able to purchase there. So those are the issues. The cost of construction, this is the cost of sale, and then the onward cost of the properties to keep them like that, because in the model of where the lady is pioneering, you don't have the ability for anybody who is not of pensionable age to come in the future. So when those who are there are saying, "Can I go?" They can't, the children of them can't have moved in, can't stay, because otherwise you lose the medal. In purchase, it's different, you own. How could we tell you who not to stay here? And the lease requires restriction. There's an example of that in the development of the eastern side of the water. There were difficulties with that. So it is a very complex area which is not resolved with just some state of the government. Thank you very much, Mr.
President. Before we leave in the statement, I wish to commend the Honourable Minister for making that ministerial statement in Parliament and not just calling a press conference. Thank you, Samuel, the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I vote to move under Standing Order 73 to the same Standing Order 71 in order to the seat of government bill.
In favour? Against? Carried. Bill is first and second reading. A bill for an act to make provisions about paying and arranging for healthcare provided outside the water and giving effect to healthcare agreements and for connected purposes. The Honourable the Deputy Chief Minister. Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that a bill to make provision about paying and arranging for healthcare provided outside the water and giving effect to healthcare agreements and for connected purposes be read a first time.
And I'll take a question. Would you say a bill for an act to make provision about paying and arranging for healthcare provided outside the water and giving effect for health care arrangements and for connected purposes, be read the first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Health Care International Agreement Act 2019. I've granted that the bill be now read a second time. To my speaker, first, the first of all, the voter and the United Kingdom would have left the European Union without a withdrawal agreement. This would have been a so-called no-deal Brexit. And first place that took us on the 29th of March. We may face it again at the end of October. This bill is one more in the raft of legislative measures that are required in order to assist our orderly departure from the European Union. The background to the bill stems from our ongoing contact with departments in the United Kingdom in the context of planning and concerted action related to Brexit. The subject matter of the original bill before the House today is healthcare. The objective is to provide a legal framework which will allow for new healthcare arrangements with EU countries once we are outside the European Union. Mr. Speaker, general members will know there are currently several arrangements where the healthcare is provided outside the water. Under those arrangements, liabilities arise and payments are made. The type of healthcare agreements that are principally the focus of the bill are healthcare agreements that the UK may enter into. In exchange for franchising the water in such arrangements, the UK may expect to be satisfied that there is adequate legal basis for payments to be made. Therefore, the proposal of Clause 3.2 is added to the bill to make it clear that such agreements fall within the scope of this legislation. The Speaker has given notice that I will be moving this and other amendments at committee stage. I will speak to those amendments at this time. The first amendment that I will be moving at the committee stage amends the title by providing the scope of the bill to include social security coordination within its mandate. The proposed new long title of the bill would therefore be an act to make provision by paying and arranging for healthcare provided outside the voter and giving effect to healthcare agreements to confer power to modify the terms to EU legislation relating to social security coordination and for connected purposes. Again, this is being done in conjunction with preparations made in the United Kingdom. The bill, as amended, will consist of three parts. The first contains the usual preliminary matters concerning the title and commencement. Part 2 concerns healthcare agreement. The purpose of this part is to provide a statutory basis for the Minister with responsibility for health to make payments that arise from the provision of healthcare outside the voting. I already explained the purpose of New 3.2, which will be added to make it clear that such agreements fall within the scope of this bill.
will decide on whether or not supplementary powers that may be exercised to make regulations or issue directions for the administration of any agreement. Clause 55 of data protection is respected. Our clause, Mr. Speaker, consists of a single clause 8 and principally confers a power to modify 5 EU regulations relating to social security coordination. This will allow the government to reflect its preferred policy if no agreement is reached with the European Union on social security coordination matters. Alternatively, it will allow the government to make changes to the regime covering those persons who fall outside the scope of any agreement that may be entered into. Mr. Speaker, as my colleague with this minister has explained, the deadline for the United Kingdom and the vote to departure from the European Union has been extended to the end of October. Nonetheless, exit could happen earlier. It is therefore essential that Gibraltar puts in place the necessary legal framework in this important field in order to provide for the eventuality that will leave the European Union at some point within the next 6 months. Mr. Speaker, I commend the bill to the House.
Before I put a question, does any honourable member wish to speak on the general principles and merits of this bill? The Honourable Ray Clinton.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I thank the Deputy Chief Minister for hearing the bill. I just have one question for him, and I apologise in advance if this has already been dealt with by the government in some other possibly for comment. And that is, I presume this is in relation really to anything with respect to the European Union, but do you have something authorised on bilateral with the United Kingdom, or is that meant to be covered by this? And one very minor point, which I think my colleague, Gamble, Edwin Rose, in the chamber, he usually points out about the bill in the short term, which will be 2019 or 2018. Thank you.
Any other honourable member wish to speak on the general principles and merits of this bill? And then call on the mover to reply.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, this is obviously in the event of a no deal budget. Now, in relation to the United Kingdom, both in relation to health and in relation to social security coordination, there are no issues. In relation to agreements the UK may make with third parties and third countries. Well, and what wants the UK as a third country, with the European Union countries and others.
And I'll put a question, which is what a bill for an act to make provision about paying and arranging for health care provided outside the border and giving effect to health care agreements and for collective purposes, including the amendment to be proposed by the Honourable Member, which is giving notice of the wrong title, be heard a second time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Health Care International Agreement Act 2019.
Well, Honourable Members agree that the committee stays on first reading of this bill be chosen for them.
I'd be honest to move that the House should resolve itself into committee to consider the following bills. The following bills for that law, namely the Health Care International Agreement Bill 2018.
A number of amendments have been circulated. They include amendments to the long title and also amendments for heading before certain clauses.
A bill for an act to make provisions about paying and arranging for health care provided outside Gibraltar and giving effect to health care agreements and for connected purposes. Clause 1 as amended, including the inclusion of titles before Clause 1.
And part of the bill.
And Mr. Chairman, 2019 instead of 2018.
2019 instead of 2018. And part of the bill.
Clause 2 as amended.
And part of the bill.
Clause 3 as amended, including the
the introduction of a new title. Stand part of the bill. Page 4. Stand part of the bill. Page 5 is amended. Stand part of the bill. Page 6 is amended. Stand part of the bill. Page 7 is amended. Stand part of the bill. New page 8. Stand part of the bill. The land title as amended, some part of the bill.
I think I have the honor to report that the Health Care International Agreement Bill 2003 has been considered in committee and agreed to with amendment, and I now move that it be read a third time in part.
I don't know. And that's the question, which is that the Health Care International Agreements Act 2019 be read a third time and carried. Those in favour? Carried. Those against? Carried. Bill, first and second reading.
I think I have the honour to move that the House is now adjourned, that is Friday the 3rd of May at 3 p.m. And I know the Speaker that the Liberty Citizen can appear, but he must be in town because there's a meeting tonight. And I look forward to seeing that.
Before I move put the adjournment, as honourable members are aware, it is a requirement under Section 69(1) of the Constitution that the estimate of expenditure for the next financial year be circulated to honourable members on a confidential basis, not later than the 30th of April. And since the House is not scheduled to meet later this month, because we'll be meeting on the 4th of May, I am proposing that the provisions of the Constitution will be deemed to have been met if the estimates are circulated to all honourable members before the end of April. This is what we have been doing for the last few years, and so I propose that it should be the case again for this year. Is that agreed?
Just one small thing so that I know is the same table. The 30th of April, before the 30th of April, the 29th is actually bank holiday, and the weekdays before that, I think on Friday, no, it's not on Friday, it's the week after. Yeah. So probably the clerk, would call us, I think, in the past, during the course of that week, before the 29th bank holiday, long weekend. Is that the estimate?
The 30th of April is not a bank holiday. That is the last day of the month. So I would imagine that the intention would be to have the estimate circulated not later than the 30th of April, no?
Yeah, I don't know what the intention is, because this is the point. The point is not so much the work on the estimate, the point is the printing of the estimate book. And I looked at this at some stage with the clerk, and I think we were clear that the last day of the month is a weekend, then the next working day is the day when the estimates have to be delivered. Now, the reason I say that, as honourable members of the field, when they see the estimates, I was quite keen for them to get them. But the reason I say that is because there are printers issues and delivery from printers issues.
Remember, the same point had to be reversed last year.
Yeah.
Right, so I now put the question to the Chief of the House, who now again to Friday, the 3rd of May at 3 in the afternoon. The House will now adjourn to Friday, the 2nd of May at 3 in the afternoon.